Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. No doubt the current political climate is contentious, but if you think this period in American history is rough, well, this hour we offer a little perspective and perhaps some small comfort in the story of our 15th president, James Buchanan. His was a one-term administration associated with disastrous events like the Dred Scott Supreme Court decision, the Panic of 1857, and the little-known Pig War. And journalist Robert Strauss is here to tell us about his research into the Buchanan presidency. His book is called Worst President Ever, James Buchanan, the POTUS Rating Game, and the Legacy of the Least of the Lesser Presidents. Robert Strauss joins us in studio. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks, Mary.
So let's start off by talking about Buchanan and the campaign of 1856. He brings to the race quite a resume.
He is the most experienced president ever, probably most experienced guy ever to run. He was a state legislator in Pennsylvania. He was a U.S. congressman, U.S. senator, ambassador to Russia, ambassador to Great Britain, and secretary of state. So if that isn't enough, you know, you can draw your breath. And he was 65 when he ran. So he had spent most of his life doing that sort of public service.
Yeah. And yet we'll talk about some of the events that came to be associated with the Buchanan presidency. But continuing for a few moments about that campaign of 1856, it was a three-way race. The Republican Party was in its infancy. What did the Republican Party represent in 1856?
Well, in 1853, we still had a Whig president, Millard Fillmore. He had succeeded after Zachary Taylor died. The Whig Party dissipated after the next election, and it devolved into two parties, more or less, the Know-Nothing Party. Now, just think about a campaign where somebody called themselves the Know-Nothing Party,
yeah.
You know, and the Republicans. And the Republicans were their main platform was, I guess, not having slavery come into the new territories. It's hard to call it anti-slavery. And the Know-Nothings were, imagine this, their big platform was against immigration, although it was Catholic immigration, mostly from Ireland and Germany, and they were going to take our jobs. So they came to Philadelphia because this was the patriotic place to hold a convention over by 12th and Market, like more or less where the Lowe's Hotel is, at a place called National Hall. And they couldn't really find anybody who would take on their mantle, except Millard Fillmore, the president who felt dissed all this time. He had never had any papers where he was anti-immigration, anti-Catholic, anything, but he really wanted bad back into the White House. So they took him on.
And, wait, before you go on,
yeah.
How did we get to the name Know-Nothing?
Oh, okay. So Know-Nothings is, if people remember back to Hogan's Heroes and Sergeant Schultz say, I know nothing, that was pretty much what it was. They would hold meetings in secret. They'd come out and people would say what happened. They'd say, I know nothing. So that's sort of where it came from. The other name for it was the American Party, but rarely known by that.
All right. So the Democratic Party had James Buchanan. He has this extensive resume, and he was also Pennsylvania's first and only presidential nominee.
Correct. He was the only president from our great state.
After 240 years as a Republican, any guesses as to why?
Well, you know, to tell you the truth, in the very beginning, everything was sort of split between New York and Virginia. Virginia got the presidents. New York, as we now all know from the musical Hamilton, got all the jobs. And there was, you know, a little smattering of Massachusetts in there where the Adams is. But pretty much there until Andrew Jackson, there wasn't a movement from other states because these were the big states. So there was sort of a coalition of secondary states that sort of promoted their next presidents. And, you know, finally, with Buchanan, it was Pennsylvania's turn.
So Buchanan wins the presidential election. What does he see as his mandate?
Okay, his mandate is to end slavery. Well, excuse me, decide on what we're going to do with slavery. It's not as if every president didn't think of this, but this was his big deal. So he sees this court case winding around with a slave named Dred Scott suing for his freedom. He had gone off. He was the slave of a military man who had gone off to what is now Minnesota for a while, came back to Missouri. He dies. Scott says he's no longer a slave. But the Supreme Court was split 5-4, much as it has been now, but it was Southerners, Northerners. So if there was a 5-4 decision on this case, it couldn't be very broad because it wouldn't have been seen as really legitimate. So what Buchanan does is he goes to his fellow Dickinson graduate, Dickinson College graduate, Roger Tawney, who's the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and says, let's see if we can do something about this. And he convinces a Northern justice, Robert Story, also a Dickinson graduate. So Dickinson's to blame for this. I don't want to say that to my friends who went to Dickinson, but anyway. So and then another Northern justice will write a concurring opinion. So now it's going to be 7-2. So whatever's going to come out.
It's a mandate.
Yeah. Well, 2 days after his inauguration, the greatest party in North America in the first part of the century, there comes this decision, and it's a complete disaster. Dred Scott, essentially what Roger Tawney, who was a slaveholder himself, wrote was that slavery was good everywhere, that the Constitution couldn't the states couldn't prohibit it, Congress couldn't pass a law, it was part of the Constitution. That just stopped the country. There had been a 20-year expansion, as you remember from your history books, the Louisiana Purchase, the Oregon Territory, Texas.
Sure.
Everybody's moving around, can move around. The railroads engender this. Well, suddenly, let's say you own, a tin cup factory in Lancaster, and you want to open up another one in Carlisle. Well, who knows? There could be slaveholders coming up and have a slave basis instead of your paid employees. So people just sort of stop. And railroads fail, businesses fail, and so on.
So Buchanan influences the outcome of the Dred Scott deliberations.
Right.
How did he feel about slavery personally?
Okay, he was what was called a doughface. He was a southern-leaning northerner. Doughface comes from the southerners could shape your face like dough.
Hmm.
His view of slavery is that it existed. Where it existed, that's the way they did things. It was not an unpopular view at that point. I mean, we think of this northern-southern split of slaves and not slaves. Most people, even in the North, accepted slavery in its place.
Hmm.
So
all right. So he influences the Dred Scott decision, which leads to what you said, 20 years?
No, excuse me. There was 20 years of expansion.
20 years of expansion. Okay.
But prior to that.
And all of a sudden.
It leads to the Panic of 1857.
Got it. Okay. And there was also the Tariff of 1857?
That also exacerbated things.
Okay. So this dovetails into the Panic of 1857. Tell us about that.
Okay. It is the most precipitous decline in our country's history. We think of the Great Depression, and I guess because, our parents or grandparents lived through it, there are stories of it. But this was a sharp drop-off. Now, you got to remember, most of the manufacturing was in the North. In the South, they still had agriculture, so they weren't as hurt by it because you could feed and clothe your family and all that sort of stuff. But all the banks in New York closed for at least one day.
Hmm.
They didn't accept paper money anymore. One of the great things that Buchanan did, apparently, and I'm going to tell you a personal story. I'm out in a coin store looking for gifts for my 25th wedding anniversary, and looking like quarters, I don't know, something. And I'm looking at the case, and I see these large coins from the early 50s, 1850s. And then there's this little coins from 1857. And so I asked the dealer, what's going on? He says, oh, the Panic of 1857. That was the solution. Huh. They made coins smaller.
Isn't that interesting?
So anyway, this Buchanan then says, can't do anything about it. You guys deserve it. You speculated on the railroads. You speculated on this. That's what you deserve. We'll get out of it with grit, just like the Southerners are by having their farms.
So his attitude was essentially hands off and just kind of let it play out. And
right.
This is, by the way, all happening during the first year of his presidency.
Yeah, first even months of his presidency, and so that leads to a greater split between North and South, because of course the North is more affected by it, and. It helps the rise of the anti-slavery movement because they see, you know, before there weren't slaves coming to the North. Now they could. I don't know that many did. It was a very short time, and you're not going to just pick up and go. But they saw the threat of that in their lives, too.
So inadvertently, Buchanan is starting to contribute to the rise of the anti-slavery movement.
Right, right. The reversal of it.
Yeah.
So the next major crisis is Kansas. And Kansas is presumably the next state to come to the Union. And we've had more or less one for one. Each time there was a slave state, there was a free state,
yeah.
More or less. But now Kansas is going to come up. And what's happened is people have come over from Missouri to start a slave, a slave constitution, a constitution that will allow slavery. And other people had a constitution in Topeka that was free soil. There were about six slaves in all of Kansas. There weren't that many, except that, you know, these Southerners are looking, well, we got to have one of them because we know that Oregon and Washington and all these places are going to come in the future. So what Buchanan's response to these two constitutions is nothing.
Again, you know? Hands off.
Hands off. He has military advisors who come there and tell him to do this or do that, or you got to do something. He does nothing, which then sort of leads eventually into fighting. And one of the person who comes out of it with the most glory is John Brown, who we, of course, all know. But he started out in Kansas. He and his sons killed presumably slaveholding families or slave enhancement families, whatever you want to call them. And he goes off, but nobody goes after him. You know, we don't sort of have Buchanan going after this guy. He eventually
just laid back.
Laid back, yeah. Did nothing.
Well, so, and at this point, across the country, what is the populace starting to think about James Buchanan this early into his presidency?
Well, he had said that he was going to be a one-term president. And, you know, the Republican Party, if you don't mind, can I go back to 1856 for a moment?
Sure.
Here? Okay. So just to show that things replicate themselves as we go along, the Republican Party nominates a celebrity. John Fremont is a celebrity. He was called the Pathfinder. He and Kit Carson mapped out the West pretty much. He comes back with these dry journals, and his new wife, the 17-year-old daughter of the longest-standing Democratic Senator Thomas Benton, Jesse Benton, gussies up his journals. She sees something in him. She's the Kris Kardashian to his Bruce Jenner, basically. And suddenly, she knows everybody in Washington, of course, because of her father. All these things come out. It becomes a bestseller. So John Fremont gets to be nominated, and that's that.
Twists.
I'll get into it.
I was going to say, there are a lot of twists and turns to this story, Robert Strauss. We're going to continue with the story of James Buchanan in just a moment. Robert Strauss is with us another 20 minutes or so here on Radio Times. If you'd like to call in, 888-477-9499. Robert Strauss is author of Worst President Ever. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We are talking about our 15th president, James Buchanan, for the next few minutes here on Radio Times. Robert Strauss is author of The Worst President Ever, and that is the story of James Buchanan. And going into the break, we were talking about the GOP was starting to rev up. This is in advance of the next election. But I wanted to get back to the fact that Buchanan had said he was going to be a one-term president. Why did he go into it with that mindset?
Well, you got to remember, 65 was pretty old then. He had been seeking the presidency for dozens of years. He had sort of run three other times. Well, ran for the nomination. So he realized this was going to be it.
All right. So let's get to, again, before we get to that election, I did want to touch on the little known Pig War. What is that, and why is it not in any school book that I've ever seen?
Well, you know, here's the thing about history. It's mostly forgotten. And in writing this book or any other book, I love the oddball stories. And the Pig War is about as oddball as you can get. There's these straits between the Olympic Peninsula and Canada up in northwest United States, ill-settled back then, disputed where the line was. And at some point, a wild pig runs onto the property of some American settler. He shoots it, kills it. Well, the pig is owned by the Hudson Bay Company. The people who run Canada, sort of the Koch brothers of Canada, if you want a modern. Anyway, so Buchanan sees this as a chance to maybe get more territory up there. So there are only 12,000 soldiers in all of America. Many of them are needed to guard real places like Washington, especially Kansas. And he sends these guys from Kansas, and they're not going in B-1 bombers. They got to walk there. It takes a long time for them to get up there. By the time they get there, I'm sure these guys had already eaten the pig. And anyway, there's no problem anymore. But he has exacerbated whatever problems he has by sending people out to places they didn't need to be.
How would you characterize Buchanan? Is it anemic as a president?
He was completely indecisive. Hmm. He had had these roles in government. That's the thing about experience in government, or his experience in government, but he was a diplomat. He was a legislator. He never really proposed any major legislation.
Also a bit of a bon vivant.
Oh, he was the best partier around. It's not, you know, like when you write something negative, you got to say the good things, right? He was hail fellow well met, as they would say in cliched terms. And like I say, a great partier. But once he gets to having to make decisions, he just can't do it.
Yeah. And again, many Philadelphia connections. His first fiance was, I guess, beautiful. And unfortunately, that story ended
pretty badly.
It did end pretty badly. Was she from Philadelphia?
They were from Lancaster. Her father had a great fortune, perhaps the richest man in the state. But her sister lived in Philly. After there was this dust up in Lancaster where gossip said that he didn't love her anymore, she broke off the engagement, came to Philly to visit her sister, and died the first night she's here, presumably committed suicide. It was over across the house that she was staying in is across from the Liberty Bell. So
yeah, and he swore off love, but that didn't last.
Yeah, you know, he was always, you know, fixed up with somebody. You know, he was a good, like I said, he was a good partier. Even at the end of his life, almost married Dolly Madison's niece, but that didn't happen.
And also, just again, there's that Philly connection. You passed along the fact that a large number of James Buchanan's papers can be found at the Historical Society of Pennsylvania.
13th and Locust. It's what inspired me to write the book.
Mm. All right, so let's get to the phones. David in Roxborough. Welcome to Radio Times. Hi, David.
This is just to add to the what you just said about the Dred Scott decision.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
The Dred Scott decision led to the Civil War because it invalidated the Missouri Compromise, which kept the peace, and Dred Scott said that Congress nor anybody else could keep slavery out of the territories, and that's the platform that the Republicans under Lincoln ran. And as soon as Lincoln was elected, the Deep South and later the Upper South seceded, which Buchanan did nothing about because he said it's unconstitutional to secede, but he had no constitutional authority to prevent that. But that's not what Andrew Jackson would have said.
Well, thank you, David, for the call into Radio Time. So, yes, after Abraham Lincoln does win the election. And by the way, James Buchanan kind of served that up to Lincoln, didn't he?
Yeah.
Because he didn't support his Democratic successor.
His one big rival was Stephen Douglas, Lincoln-Douglas debates. And he really screwed it up for him because he, as the head of the party, put the convention in Charleston, South Carolina, where they're never going to nominate an Illinois candidate. So the party broke up into three, pretty much assuring Lincoln's election. No matter what we think of Lincoln, he was not the most popular man in America kind of thing. Mm. He sort of slid into the presidency.
Yeah. Well, so before Lincoln actually takes office, while Buchanan is still president for a couple more months, a number of states secede.
Eventually, seven states secede before Lincoln becomes president. And as the caller said, the Buchanan's idea was, once again, can't do much about that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The Constitution says I can't force them back.
Well, how do you interpret this? Was this just a character flaw? Was he paralyzed by indecision or fear? Or really, was he just a person who didn't think too deeply or worry too much?
I think, like I said, I think that he was a conciliatory kind of person. He took advice, and never came to a decision. He was mostly influenced by Southerners, which made any decision that he really did make or any influence that he did have looking towards the South, because he felt that that was how the nation was going to stay together.
Yeah. So there are other presidents who might compete with Mr. Buchanan for worst president ever. And, and you do talk about some of those. Let's go back to the Panic of 1857. And you did bring up the Great Depression of 1929. There are those who might rank Herbert Hoover as the worst president because of the Great Depression.
Right. Well, you know, here's the great thing about my theory is that I really loved the idea of people arguing with me about this. And so, yes, I came up with James Buchanan. But, Hoover does have a little problem with the Great Depression.
Just a little problem.
But he tried to do something about it. And he tried to pass various laws. Now, they were ineffective eventually. So it doesn't make him Lincoln. But at least it doesn't make him Buchanan.
We've got more calls coming in to 888-477-9499. James, you are up next on Radio Times. James in Malvern. Hi, James.
Hey, how you doing? My question's kind of tongue-in-cheek. I was just wondering, the name of the book is Worst President Ever. I was wondering if your guest was doing his research during the Bush administration and never saw any news.
I have to think. What we suffer from contemporaneousness often, and my elevator pitch to my agent on this book was, of course, before this particular election. And it's like half America thought George Bush was the worst president ever, and half thought Barack Obama was, but neither of them started the Civil War.
All right, so we're talking about George W. here, James?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, you can. I also think we have a special viciousness against our presidents.
Go ahead. Yeah.
You know, because we might not like our congressman, but we don't hate him. You know, and I think that there's it just engenders this negative disposition towards our presidents.
Why is that? Because you do write instead of criticism, it's vitriol.
Yeah, it's the top guy. You know what I mean? It's the same way, like the Wells Fargo CEO getting. All this vituperation. Well, if it was the Wells Fargo vice president, it wouldn't be the same kind of thing. It's how we hate some actor because who knows why, or some singer. Oh, his music is bad, but only if he's the best. You know, so I think that's part of the problem is that the president is the top guy. So you're resentful.
Well, we know what the conversation is like in 2016, as far as the vitriol is concerned. Right. Can you give us a sense of what was happening back in 1857, what was being said?
Okay, well, here's the thing. Another thing about the campaign, you can count the number of major speeches that the three candidates gave on one hand, and that's zero.
Really?
They did not go out and do that sort of thing. There were, as we call them now, surrogates who would go out. One of the funny things about the campaign is that Buchanan's sister-in-law's brother was Stephen Foster, sort of the Jay-Z of his age, the most popular entertainer and songwriter, who, by the way, never saw the Suwannee River because he was from Pittsburgh. So he wrote several songs for Buchanan. But then also the Fremont campaign took Stephen Foster melodies and put their campaign songs to them. So it was like they were trying to figure out, well, you know, people would hear this and say, well, even his brother-in-law doesn't like him.
Where would people hear this? The
town square, exactly. Yeah. There would be singing groups. I mean, this is just the way it was. And there would be parties, and especially in the summer, July 4th, or picnics, whatever else you would do. So that's where you would hear them. They would also be written. I mean, this was the first. There had been songs before, but this was the first campaign that really had a lot of songs to it.
How quickly did news travel in that day?
Slowly, but not as slowly as you think. Gossip was as big as it is now. The newspapers were definitely partisan. That's part of what you did. I mean, Buchanan set up newspapers in every state that were the Democratic newspaper in every city. It was a big contract. It was a printing contract. So news traveled slowly, but in a definitely determined manner. And you also have to remember that as many people voted in the 1856 election as will vote in Indiana this year, 4 or 5 million people. So it's not that many people to influence. They're all landed white men.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get to some of the lesser presidents, to some more of the lesser presidents. Franklin Pierce, our 14th president.
Yeah, he I would say, ranks second. And the only reason he really succeeds.
Second is the worst president ever behind Buchanan. Okay.
Yeah, he pretty much had the same views. He was the handsomest president, and his best friend was Nathaniel Hawthorne. So he was an intellectual president. And he was the only president to have the cabinet all the way through. But his big advisor was Jefferson Davis, who, as people may remember, became the president of the Confederacy. And the only reason he ranks ahead of him, I would say, is that there really was no Civil War after his term.
Mm. He was a doughface.
He was a doughface, too, even from New Hampshire.
And he supported what was called, was it the Austin or Ostend Manifesto?
Which was written by Buchanan. And it was
which wanted to acquire Cuba.
Cuba as a slave state. Or maybe more than one slave state, depending on how it was, and get the Spanish out of North America.
So another of the presidents that you mentioned is among the lesser presidents, of course, Richard Nixon.
Yeah,
who had
Watergate.
There was Watergate. Well, on the other side, he did begin the EPA. He did open up our relationship with China, but of course, Watergate.
Yeah. So it depends on whether you think that is the deciding factor. And I say the Civil War is the deciding factor. I always say Buchanan is the second most consequential American. Washington being the first started everything. Buchanan pretty much, you know, if Lincoln hadn't come along and made a few good moves, we would have been two countries.
Well, some of our more beloved presidents had short resumes.
Yes.
Before they were elected. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, in all the great historical surveys, the top three guys are always Washington, Lincoln, and FDR in some order. And if you note, you know, Lincoln barely served in legislatures before that. He famously lost the Lincoln-Douglas debates. Similarly, FDR lost as a vice presidential candidate, lost a primary in a Senate primary in New York, was governor of New York, so that's a big job. But he didn't have that long a resume either. And Washington, of course, didn't have the opportunity to have one.
Sure. Is there a civics lesson in here somewhere, Robert Strauss?
I think the civics lesson is you got to have a decisive person. I mean, no matter, you know, liberals may think Ronald Reagan is an anathema, but he was very decisive. Anytime he said he was going to do something, he did it. And that's what you sort of need to become a better president, I think.
So in general, and you kind of just touched on this, but experiences which are predictive of a successful presidency are what?
Like I say, decisiveness.
Yeah.
A successful one.
Yeah.
So decisiveness.
Yeah.
The personality that will synthesize information and come out with a conclusion and say that this is a good conclusion. Washington certainly did. I mean, there are many famous books written about Washington. Listen to all his advisors, and he would come up with something.
Yeah.
And so that's pretty much how I would say the better presidencies worked out.
Yeah, you say the presidency is a unique post and it requires a combination of skills and talents that is not reflected in any other position.
I would say that.
So tell us about how you went about researching this book and getting information about a man who lived, you know, well over a century ago.
It's fun. You know, I was.
You started from the beginning. You found the log cabin in which he was born.
Yeah, the log cabin in which he was born. It's now on the Mercersburg Academy campus. It's sort of funny because it sits there. And from what I understand from friends who have gone there, it's sort of the place where people go make out and smoke dope or whatever it is, you know.
It's not Monticello.
Not Monticello. It's a little – and, you know, it sort of looks like the place where Santa Claus would be on Christmas, you know, out front. And it's – I was also fortunate that Dickinson College had a grant many years ago to digitize all of Buchanan's papers. And now historians will have a chance to do that. The Library of Congress has a new – leader, and she is very big on digitizing everything, mostly for kids, so that you can sit home on your computer and read Buchanan's letters. You know? And
What is the sense of the man that you get from the letters that you have been able to read?
He was nice and oblivious. You know, he really wanted to please everybody. He's a man who never said a word, or at least never wrote a word bad about anybody. I've read many, many, many letters about him and by him, and you cannot find him saying other. He might not agree with their political positions, but even Stephen Douglas, who he hated, never said anything bad about him. So, you know, he would have been a nice guy to hang out with, but as president, really bad.
Yeah. Did he have a successful home life, family life?
He did. Well, he did because he raised his youngest niece from her parents had died. He did give a lot of money to his nieces and nephews. He was a rich guy from his being a lawyer. And she was one of the great characters. She should actually, Lynn Miranda should read about her. It could be the Harriet Lane musical. She was the Jackie Kennedy of her age. She was the hostess. She was the first person to really be called a first lady. Everything she wore, everybody wanted to wear. She met all the dignitaries. She danced with everybody at every party. There was a Coast Guard cutter named the Harriet Lane. Even when it was captured by the Confederates, they didn't rename it because she was so popular. And into her, she gave her art collection that started the National Gallery of Art. So he created a good example for his relatives.
We've got about 10 seconds left. What did he think of Abe Lincoln?
What do you think of Abe Lincoln? He supported Abe Lincoln through the Civil War, so he had to think of him as a good man.
All right. Well, it was great having you here, Robert Strauss. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
He is author of Worst President Ever, James Buchanan, The POTUS Rating Game, and The Legacy of the Least of the Lesser Presidents. Coming up after the break, if this year's presidential election is giving you agita, you're not alone. Over half of American adults in a recent survey say there is stress caused by this election. We'll talk about it. Keep it here. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. When will this election be over? An awful lot of people are asking that question during one of the more combative presidential contests in memory. In fact, a new survey from the American Psychological Association has found that over half of Americans find the 2016 election to be a significant source of stress. And joining us now to discuss the survey's findings and what this will mean to our well-being is Lynn Bufka, a clinical psychologist and APA Associate Executive Director for Practice Research and Policy. Welcome, Lynn, to Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I'm going to guess that the results of this survey were not a shock to you?
Well, I think part of the reason we asked the question is that we were certainly aware from anecdotal comments that people were saying, hey, this is really stressing me out. So that the fact that half of our respondents are saying, yes, this is a significant source of stress, it was consistent with everything that we've been observing. It was nice to see some numbers supporting it.
Yeah, and party affiliation apparently doesn't matter here.
No, Democrats and Republicans both are saying this is a stressful election cycle.
Well, Lynn Bufka, how about gender? Are women perhaps more stressed about this election than men, or vice versa?
Yeah, interestingly, we didn't see a difference in gender. People reporting the election cycle as a source of stress. We often find gender differences in stress, but not around the election.
How is this stress showing up at home, on the road, or in the office?
That's a really good question. And stress, all stress, and we don't know for sure if the election stress is different or not. But, you know, stress, when we're feeling stressed, we typically are not handling our responsibilities as well. We're more prone to irritability, to conflict with others in our lives, snapping at family members or coworkers. We might be less focused at work because we're feeling some stress. Stress certainly can impact our sleep habits. So it can have a broad range of effects on us.
So if any one of us is feeling these effects and that's out of the norm, how might we make the connection to the election? Is it as obvious as, say, you know, watching the debate and then not sleeping afterwards?
Right. Well, I think a lot of people are aware that their conversations or exposure to content about the election is getting them agitated, getting them sort of aroused, stressed, feeling stressed about it. And if you know that that is going on for you, it's important to be pretty active about how to manage that. We can't, the election's not going away, not for another month. And it's important that we stay informed about what's happening. But if the constant news and all that we're seeing related to the election really is making us get sort of agitated and wound up and all of that, do things to limit your exposure to it by perhaps not watching every aspect of the coverage, by selectively choosing sources of information, by actively setting limits on conversations with coworkers or family members. You know, if you know this is stuff that tends to get you pretty agitated, don't engage. Do things to limit that. But if it's unavoidable, on the flip side of it, do things you know are helpful in managing stress. And for a lot of us, that can be things as everyday and so important to our well-being as getting regular exercise, trying to ensure good sleep, you know, tuning off from digital stuff after a certain period in the evening, whether it's election or otherwise. But doing all the things that we know are good self-care, it's important to do that when we've got a clear known stressor. It's even more important to be aware of what we need and then to act appropriately for our own well-being.
So if the conversation is heating up at the water cooler and you're feeling that anxiety rise, maybe it's a good time to take that walking break.
That's absolutely true. And if you can't necessarily walk away from it, you know, assert yourself a little bit and say, you know, we've all been talking about the election a lot. Let's move on to another topic. Sometimes other people may be equally relieved that you voiced your stated that and tried to move on to another topic.
Well, I do want to jump in here with the phone number, because if this is something that rings a bell, give us a call at 888-477-9499, or you can also send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So Lynn Bufke, it is critical to be well informed, and it is also really important to be able to walk away, but you want to remain informed at the same time. So how do we find balance?
It's a good question. I think one possibility is to think about sort of where do I find good sources of information, and to use those sources of information, and to not then, once I've read the latest story, don't delve into all the comments on a website. You know, you don't need to get into that, because those are the things I personally find that especially get me going, to see the combativeness back and forth in the comments. For some people, different forms of information may be better, whether it's seeing an analysis after the fact or watching the debate. There may be different ways that you personally take in information and process it. Go with the ones that work better for you, and don't feel compelled to stay on top of everything. Chances are there's not going to be something that happens immediately that's going to sway what you need to know about the election. You can find that information out after 24 hours and people had a chance to digest it and understand what it means. So you may decide you need to limit your time on Twitter or Facebook or other kinds of social media. If your feed is constant about the election, go ahead and limit your exposure to it for a little while, just to give yourself a break from it.
Okay, so that's one thought or so going into, say, watching the debate tonight. Any other advice before we flip on the radio or the TV at 9?
Well, I think another thing is if you anticipate that the debate is going to get you worked up, get you really kind of stressed and agitated, know that going into it and have a plan for what you're going to do afterwards. Maybe you're not going to watch the responses from various pundits afterwards. Maybe you're going to decide, I'm going to take the dog out on the final walk afterwards just to have a little time to decompress and get away from the news. Or maybe I'm going to work on a crossword puzzle. Whatever you do that gives you some mental break, plan ahead to make that happen, and feel free to turn that TV off and go do that next thing. So it comes back to being aware of our own proclivities and being prepared to handle what comes our way in ways that work for us individually.
So, Lynn Bufka, suffice it to say, there's a lot of emotion around the 2016 presidential campaign. What are you hearing from couples or from families who are split down the middle, Trump-Clinton?
You know, we didn't get into that in our survey. So my response to that is going to be based on what I'm hearing from conversations and people around me. And it is difficult. It is very difficult when you see that. I don't know. I'm not finding it so much with couples. I think, you know, we tend to align with people who share our points of view. So it's often an issue with extended families and with coworkers, where you are in situations where you didn't necessarily choose that person and you've got some very different points of view. And there's definite tension there. We don't, you know, human beings, we don't want to be in conflict with one another. That's sort of not our natural state. Our natural state is to want to be working together and getting along. So being in conflict like that is definitely stressful for individuals. And there may very well need to be some negotiating around, we clearly are not going to see the same way on this, so we're going to have to let it go.
Okay.
That's an important skill to do with all kinds of areas. If there's not a way to resolve it and come to the same point of view, negotiating and being able to say, we both have different points of view on this, and we're going to have to let it go, that can be really important to do for all kinds of topics. The election this year is certainly one of them.
The APA also says stressing about what might happen on November 8th is not productive, which is easier said than done.
Absolutely. We know that about all kinds of things. You know, worrying about the future, trying to hold off all those negative what-ifs. Our worry doesn't prevent bad things from happening or make good things happen. Our actions might do something, but if we get stuck in those spirals of, well, what if this happens? What if this person's elected and they do this and then this happens? We don't have any control over that aspect of it, and going down that worry path is only going to get us more distressed.
Yeah. And also, go ahead. I'm sorry, Lynn.
So I was going to say, it's just really important to try to look at those worries to see how realistic they are or not, you know, and try to maintain a little more balanced perspective about it. It's much easier said than done. I know that, but it is something that if we can do it, it really can be beneficial for us.
And the American Psychological Association reminds us that there are three branches of government, so that whatever happens November 8th, whomever's elected, there are checks and balances in place for a reason.
That's right.
I know people who are so disenchanted with both major party candidates, Lynn, that they say they're going to sit this one out. What is your reaction?
You know, I find that a little discouraging. I think we have had a successful democracy for over 200 years, and that is because citizens are engaged and do exercise their right to vote. So I really encourage people to do that. But I also would encourage people to keep in mind this is not just about a national election. There are local elections and state elections, school board elections. There may be ballot proposals that have a very close to home impact on your life. So if you're not sure what to do about the presidential election, there may be some local elections that really do matter. Get some information about those. Find out what the issues are in your local area and make informed choices on election day. That may actually help you feel like you are doing something, even though it's not going to be the deciding. The one person is unlikely to be the vote that makes the decision, but you are making your contribution to the process, and that often makes us feel like we've got a little bit of control over something, that we've done our part. So I would really encourage people to pay attention to what's happening at the state and local level and get engaged there.
All right. We've got calls coming in to 888-477-9499. And let's get to one of them. Pam is in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And hi, Pam. How are you today?
Hi. It's a great topic. I came in late, but it really hit home. Because I've got to tell you, when I see, like, look at my Twitter feed during the day and just see all the stuff, and it really makes me stressed out, you know? Mm-hmm. And so what I started doing is I keep a track phone around that just for emergencies, and I've been forwarding my calls from my iPhone to my track phone, which doesn't get internet, and I turn off the iPhone and put it away for the whole day while I'm working. I work at home. And that really helps quite a bit.
It really has helped you.
Yes.
Lynn, what do you think?
I think any time that we can feel like we are putting some control over our exposure to social media is a good thing. I think it's too easy to let it just come at us all the time, but setting some times like that where I'm not tracking this now, I'm just doing this aspect of it with using my phone for the phone purpose and nothing more, I think that's a wonderful thing to be doing.
A great idea. Thanks for the call into Radio Times, Pam. So Lynn Bufka, Steve Stosny, a therapist in Washington, D.C., or the Washington, D.C. area, has dubbed the anxiety he's seeing in his office as election stress disorder. And he says one of the hallmarks is a sense of powerlessness. And you kind of addressed this earlier, but worth going to it one more time as we wrap this show up. What's your take? What's the remedy for powerlessness?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One is if we're fearing powerlessness about the election, and I can understand why people would. It's a big election. Lots of people are going to vote. Will my vote make a difference? Think about ways that you can feel like you can make a difference on the issues that are important to you. Are there local groups or communities that are working on the things that are important to you? Get engaged with those. Get your voice out in ways where you feel you are making a difference. Think about that in terms of your voting as well, whether at the local or state level, where you may feel like you have more opportunity to make a difference there. As collectively as a society, the citizenry does have the power. We are electing the individuals. We may not as one individual, but engaging with others who feel similarly about topics and are approaching them with a similar mindset to us may help us feel like we do have a little more voice and power in this than thinking of ourselves as one individual, one drop in the whole ocean, because we really are in an ocean with others who do share our points of view. And if we can find them and work with them, that may help us feel a little less powerless in the whole situation.
Time for one more call. Rose in Flemington, New Jersey. Welcome to Radio Times, Rose.
Thank you for taking my call. I would like to address the fact that all the dunning that's going on, specifically on the AM dial, is professionally produced. It is really sad to wander around like late at night and listen to the radio. It almost reminds me of the original Manchurian Candidate. We are so... It's pounded in. It's almost like a form of torture worked up by the CIA. And it just breaks my heart to hear people are going to not vote when if we would go to third-party candidates, number one, they would be involved financing. They get their $10 million, and they would be in the debates.
You know what, Rose? I'm going to
change on this.
Let me just take your point because we're closing up on the end of the show here. We're closing in on the end of the show. Lynn Bufka, there's a lot of political spin, and again, you know, Rose is not happy with what she's hearing in some places on the radio dial. And as we head out, what are some thoughts again as far as avoiding some of the stuff that is upsetting?
Well, I certainly hear your caller's point of view on that. I had the TV on the other day and was horrified at hearing all of the election campaign commercials, and these were for local elections. So I think we can exercise the power button and just turn it off. I mean, first and foremost, we don't have to listen and recognize that there is spin that's going on there. And as your caller is saying, we largely have a two-party system, but there are certainly other candidates trying to get in there. Having greater voices in the mix will probably really help all of us have a more balanced understanding of what's happening. But for our own personal well-being and what we need to do in order to manage our stress, I think we need to take control over our exposure to that stress, whether it's what we're hearing in radio or what we're hearing from the people around us. But we can do our best to set some limits around that to have it not get us as agitated.
Yeah. Lynn Bufka, it was a pleasure. We appreciate the input.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Lynn Bufka is APA Associate Executive Director for Practice, Research, and Policy. And remember to visit our Facebook page, take a listen to our podcasts. Simply head to whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, thanks for listening to Radio Times.